And this chapter is kind of a central chapter for that. Then in the next couple of chapters after that, he's going to start connecting this model of moral foundations to personality and to political morality. And so we're going to start to get an idea of how people vary in terms of their investment in these five foundations. And then he's going to add a sixth. So there's a lot coming in the story. But before we get to any of that, since he used a big food metaphor, which is kind of corny. Did you find the restaurant thing kind of a corny way to begin the chapter? Okay. You know, and since I'm teaching food, so suddenly this food metaphor really resonated with me. So I want to start today's class actually by telling you a little bit about a topic that you probably didn't realize you wanted to know about, called retronasal olfaction, which is a topic in philosophy of food. Retronasal, let's get some images, that's what we want. And it really has to do with the current theories about how we actually smell things, how we experience taste in food. And I think this is relevant. So at the beginning, it's just going to seem like a digression. So here's the food story. So we were just talking about this in philosophy of food last week, so I'll share it with you. And I think it's relevant. So we don't sniff, you know. I mean, you can sniff. You can sniff stuff, you know, like food in the refrigerator. But we don't really, our primary way of experiencing food isn't through sniffing, and it isn't even, were taught the tongue map when you were growing up? It's totally bogus. There's no such thing as a tongue map. Every part of your tongue can experience sweet, sour, bitter, umami, which is the puzzling one, sometimes called savory. Anyway, most of our experience of flavor actually comes from being able, is this a good picture? No, there's an even better one here, let's see. Being able to take these airborne molecules from food and, I don't know if I like that one either. And what we do is we kind of suck them up into this part of our brain. This one will show it really well. It's a small one though. Okay, let's see if we can make it bigger. Whoops. Yeah, all right, let's settle for that. So what we do, I mean, we do experience orthonasal olfaction, and we do experience things on our tongue, and we experience all kinds of, you know, satisfactions from other qualities of food. But the flavonoids in food, the molecules in food that can become airborne and become the basis of taste, get sucked up into our nasal passages in the back, and there's this receptor area. It looks like a little cloud. The rain is coming from there. And it's right, you know, it's connected to your brain. It's just it's this site on inside the nasal cavity on the other side of your brain. And that site has these little receptors that can lock onto the molecules that we can experience taste from. So far, that's pretty straightforward. The cool part of retronasal olfaction is that your brain gets involved in the taste experience. So you don't take any notes on this, but it is kind of interesting that people talk about there being a taste image because the brain actually you don't just experience the fixed sensations of those molecules, you experience a kind of full-blown image of the taste which your brain helps supply. So the really interesting news in retronasal olfaction, we haven't known this for very long, is that it helps explain the seemingly limitless flavors that humans can experience from their food. That's always been very puzzling. You know, people have very diverse ranges of flavors. You know now with the coffee gastronomy that people are trying to encourage you to detect butternut flavors, butterscotch flavors in your coffee. I mean, you can kind of throw up your hands and say, well, this is crazy. People are making this up. But what it might be going on is that we're having a gastronomic explosion because we have these big brains that allow us to basically add a kind of complexity to taste so that when we experience taste, we're not just experiencing a fixed sensation from the food. Does that make sense? Okay, now before I forget that we're in ethics, I better stop talking about retronasal olfaction. But it is cool. It's part of the reason we have virtually limitless opportunities to experience flavor and taste. We're not stuck with just, you know, sweet, sour, etc. Now, the reason that's relevant to ethics today is because Haidt used this metaphor of moral sense to taste. So let's start our notes here. Haidt had this analogy between moral senses and taste. And he's going to use the analogy in the first part of the chapter in a couple of ways, but the first thing we should unpack for your notes is just a couple of reasons, a couple of things that he's trying to get out of this. One thing he means is that, like taste, we have certain things that really matter to us. So sweetness matters to us. Bitterness was, of course, one of the ways we detected poisons in food and in our ancestral environment. So super tasters are people who have lots of taste buds per square inch on their tongue. And there's an evolutionary theory that super tasters were the people that we used to taste food that we weren't sure about because they had a sensitivity to bitterness. Or that, in general, having a sensitivity to bitterness is adaptive. So the first point he's making about ethics, though, is that we may have ethical sensitivities around different areas. And just to keep there from being suspense here, let's lay this out. CFLOS is our acronym, right? Because today we're getting this, I've kind of broken the suspense, right? I've been portraying this, it's care, harm, right? Fairness, can you help me with this? Loyalty, betrayal. What's the one for fairness? Fairness, unfairness?
Justice?
I forgot. Cheating, right. Cheating. I'll write it out to remember. There's authority and subversion, and then there's sanctity and degradation. So what I really would like you to just memorize is the acronym CFLOS, and because these are the five moral foundations. And later in a later chapter, he's going to take fairness and break it out into another one that he's going to call liberty oppression. So when I say sensitivities, what I mean is, like, as with taste, he thinks our moral experience has these little focus areas, sort of like sweet, sour, umami. And these sensitivities, put it in your notes, these sensitivities might come from our evolutionary past. Are we okay? Oh, are we getting registered for the... Okay, no. I want to stay on top of it. I want to be... Okay, so... So we'll get into the evolutionary story a little bit later, but that's not the first thing he wants out of the metaphor. The second thing he wants out of the metaphor is that morality is rich. It's not just about one thing. And that's really relevant to the work we've done so far, right? So let's just amplify that in your notes. Morality is a rich way of looking at the world, not just a way of applying a single principle or rule to every situation and every person. So he's challenging the universalism that we've seen the philosophers tell us needs to be part of ethics. You have to universalize Kant. You have to have kind of you have to be talking at a general level. Singer was telling us that. So he's going to say that philosophers, putting it this way, philosophers have gotten on the wrong track partly because they thought morality was one thing, like one taste, right? So you think about our philosophical theories champion single principles, like the principle of utility, Kant's categorical imperative, right? And what he wants to say, maybe you can't reduce ethics to that. Maybe ethics is like seeing the world aesthetically. It just involves a lot of capacities. And even reducing it to these five or six might turn out to be falsifying. And like cuisine, it's the third point he's trying to make here, about the metaphor. Like cuisine, he's saying there's a lot of variation, but not everything goes, right? So one of the problems you have if you don't boil morality down to a single principle is that somebody's going to come back at you and say, oh, you mean it can be any one of a variety of things? You can be focused on these values or maybe these values? Sounds like relativism, right? So what Haidt wants to say is, yeah, there's a lot of variation, just like with the cuisines of the world. You know, there's a lot of different cuisines out there, but it doesn't mean that anything is food, right? There are boundary conditions to what counts as looking at the world ethically. So he's trying to respond to that relativism problem that we ran into earlier in the term, okay? So that's where he's going with that. Now, he has this little section on, by the way, we do have I think it'll be a nice small group experience today, so let's get to that as soon as we can. So that's the first part, this analogy of morality to a cuisine, and, we kind of teased out some of the ideas there. But he kind of takes us back into the philosophical history, so draw a little line in your notes, and let's kind of add some detail to this. I'm going to show you a picture of Jeremy Bentham that's going to gross some of you out. Oh, by the way, this is Singer's recent book. I bought it for the library. I had the library buy it with your tuition dollars. good use of your dollars, especially small books. Lately, I'm really liking small books. This is Singer's recent book on famine, affluence, and morality. We might make use of it if we do that topic again next year. But since you all wrote about absolute poverty, I thought I might pass it around and see if you found it interesting. Okay. All right, so now we're going back into the philosophy world. He's going to take us back to tell us one more thing about what's wrong with Enlightenment philosophy. So let's go ahead and get that out. And the point for your notes is this. The Enlightenment was involved in a reductive task. And the task was to challenge the prior reductivism of medieval philosophy. So Enlightenment rationalists, because not all people in the Enlightenment were rationalists, right? Hume down here is an empiricist. That means he thinks knowledge begins with observation. But the medieval period thought there was a transcendent source of values called God. The Enlightenment set up a transcendent source of values called reason. And let's get that out of your notes. Haidt's criticism is that Hume was against both of these projects. He had to argue against both of these projects because Enlightenment empiricism really takes its departure from this other Enlightenment movement. So for Enlightenment rationalism, you've got utilitarianism. Right, Bentham first, and then Mill. And you've got Kant, right? Am I right in thinking that all of you could explain to me in what sense utilitarians and Kantians embody this Enlightenment rationality? Can we make that clear? So they're Enlightenment rationalists. Why? Because they think morality can be boiled down to one principle. For Kant, it's the categorical imperative. For utilitarians, it's the principle of utility. So that's like the restaurant where they only serve sweet, right? So that's that criticism. So the criticism that you need in your notes is that falsifies morality. Morality is a really rich way of looking at the world, and these Enlightenment figures, they gave us great theories. Utilitarianism and Kantianism is still part of our vocabulary. It's a really useful part of our vocabulary, but as you know, I don't think it solves the problem of the nature of morality. And that's what Enlightenment thinkers thought they were doing. They thought they were telling us what the essence of morality is. Now, Hume, even though he didn't have the benefit of modern evolutionary theory, Hume is pretty sure that both of these are bad answers. And what they both miss is the role of the emotions in morality. Remember, Hume is famous for saying that reason is the slave of the passions, right? And that connects back in Haidt to the theme of the first part of the book. Intuitions come first, reasoning second, right? Reason is the slave of the passions. So Haidt's criticism of the project of philosophical ethics is that, like the restaurant that only serves one flavor, it falsifies the complexity of moral experience. But within the Enlightenment, you did have this empiricist movement, which eventually does connect to science and to evolution. So Hume, for Haidt's perspective, Hume is the right side of history when it comes to understanding morality. Just to make his point really clear, he has this kind of Does anybody think that the discussion about Bentham being autistic was a little mean? Did you think it was a little harsh? Yeah, it was a little harsh. Some of my colleagues were just scandalized by that. Is it really true that Jonathan Haidt said that Bentham and Kant were like borderline Asperger's or autistic? But yeah, he is kind of saying that. Here's his point, though. Okay, so let's see if we can figure out what his point is. They were, by the way. I mean, they were pretty weird. Okay, you want to see the picture of Bentham? Have you seen this? These are pretty idiosyncratic people. So Jeremy Bentham, if you're ever in London, you need to go to the University of London and visit Jeremy Bentham. He's in the foyer. And the reason he's in the foyer is because he gave a lot of money to the University of London, but he said that he needed to be present at all the trustee meetings after his Lisbon death. So they had him stuffed. And his head is between his legs, and he's got like a wax head. And
okay, yeah. No, I was just like, why is there two heads? I don't get it.
Yeah, the two heads, that was puzzling. And so he's in the foyer, you go into the University of London, it's in the Bloomsbury neighborhood, and you see him there, and there's a little display, because in the 70s he was starting to go off a little bit, and this is like after 100 years, and so they had to like restuff him. So I think he's got straw in his body, just like a teddy bear. And I think they do wheel him out and bring him into the room for the trustee meetings. Bentham.
That's wildly disturbing and morbid.
That's a strange guy. Okay, am I right? So this isn't all Haidt doing character assassination. Bentham had this idea, among many strange ideas, that famous people should be stuffed like this and put in gardens in public places so that we could visit them. Well, sort of a variation on the graveyard theme. We just thought like this would be good for us to be aware of these people. So what we think when we think of people who have autism spectrum disorders, which now we know includes a lot of people and most philosophers probably, they tend to be people who are systematizers. Remember that scale? What page is that in your book? That quadrant scale where they put. Is it high empathy here or high empathy, low systematizing, high systematizing, and so this is the autism quadrant over here.
The bottom part of that quadrant.
And so Kant and Bentham both get located over here. This could also be the philosophy neighborhood, because in a way, philosophers are people who abstract a lot from the richness of experience and emotional experience. Not all philosophers. We vary. But the point for your notes would be that philosophy involves a kind of abstraction that sometimes results in high systematizing and low empathy. So recent fields in philosophy, like feminist philosophy, attempt to correct this. By getting us back into the data, the rich data of human experience, especially related to gender, for example. But it is a fair criticism of philosophers that we tend toward the high systematizing, because remember, we're trying to come up with theories. And so we try to abstract from things that we think are irrelevant. And as you saw from the Dewahl Korsgaard Singer experience, remember those essays, those philosophers' responses? A lot of the way they're responding to Dewahl is by saying, what really makes human morality is when we have this principle on board. And that's why gradualism's false, right? So it's, again, an example of systematizing. All right, so it's a retreat from observation. Philosophers actually, unfortunately, are not known to be the most observant people, which is embarrassing because you'd think that having a good theory about something would start with observing carefully. Okay, fair enough. There's just something about abstraction in philosophy, and I think it's a problem for philosophy. So anyway, I won't digress on that. The point for your notes is it should be pretty clear by now, which is that the Enlightenment gave us two kinds of philosophy, one very rationalist, which took us away from emotions and moral sense theory and seeing morality as an extension of our emotional capacities, and one, Hume, the empiricist tradition, which really brought us closer to seeing morality that way. And remember, Hume is a Scottish Enlightenment guy. he's up there with Adam Smith and Hutchison and other people who are saying, hey, you know, maybe it's the moral emotions like sympathy and empathy that really are the basis of morality. And they were saying that before Darwin, before people started speculating about evolutionary ethics and moral psychology. Okay, so that section of the chapter is a way of finally, this is the last time he's going to talk about philosophers so much, and it's a way of kind of separating himself from the project of philosophical ethics and aligning himself with naturalism, really. And as we've said, you know, naturalists are people who try to study philosophical problems. In philosophy, naturalists are people who study philosophical problems without reverting to transcendent realities like God and reason. That doesn't mean naturalists can't believe in God. It just means that they don't see appealing to a transcendent reality as a good way of explaining things, okay? So that's a really big change in philosophy, and you don't have to agree with it. There's plenty of, like, Korsgaard is a contemporary Kantian philosopher, right? She's all about reason. Okay, questions about that? Are we good on that? Okay, we're getting close to our small group work. We're almost ready for that, okay? Okay, so here's where he kind of gets you to this. He's trying to take you through his thinking and the people he was influenced by, and he really develops this schema, which we're going to work on in small group discussion, really by working with another person. I can't remember the person's name now. It was Greg something. Craig Joseph, University of Chicago. So here's their core intuition. I'm going to try and explain this, you know, as succinctly as I can. A cognitive module for an evolutionary psychologist is a kind of capacity that we have from our ancestral environments, that is the long prehistory that humans had before agriculture, before history and agriculture. And it's a kind of capacity that comes about as in evolution because it responds to a problem. So the point for your notes is that evolutionary psychology posits that our evolution involved some core challenges, and we're the people who succeeded, we're the descendants of the people who succeeded in meeting those challenges, and one way they met those challenges is by showing capacities that were relevant to surviving and thriving. And so we are selected for those capacities, right? They didn't come out of nowhere. They existed in a distribution in a population. Some people in the population use those capacities to gain a selective advantage over others. And those are the people who survived. Those were their ancestors. I mean, were their descendants. So for instance, you know what's handy to have is a good snake detection module? Detection. Anyway. It's good to have a good nose for foul food, right? It's good to have a good sense of when somebody's betraying you. You see, you can move to those more moral things. So the claim they're making here is that in our evolution, we had challenges that we met in a variety of ways, and we developed these kinds of modules, but they're actually kind of flexible. They have original triggers. And because we have these wonderful big brains, they can be re-triggered. They can be repurposed with contemporary triggers. So one of the things I want you to keep flipping back and forth as I'm talking to this chart. What page is that on in your book?
146.
Okay, maybe you guys could open that up and keep it handy. Because you see it has a row for the adaptive challenge of each of these foundations, the original triggers, and the current triggers. And what he's saying with this original versus current is, hey, we've got huge brains. We're not just stuck looking for snakes, right? Snakes are a problem. I still keep my eye out for snakes. But we've got complicated problems today. So the original triggers that our evolutionary past gave us are not the ones that we're stuck with. But these modules give us, they're like taste receptors. They're capacities to experience things and notice things. And we can repurpose them as new experience comes along. And that's because we've just got these beautiful big brains, right? 1,400 cc's. That's huge. We started out at like 400 cc's. And that was way after we were like lorises and tarsiers and lemures. So, I mean, we tripled brain size. Okay?
So let's go ahead and get into some of the...
What you have in your notes is a view about the way evolutionary psychology postulates modularity as a way of explaining capacities that are in our evolved psychology. An example of modularity would be an ability to detect snakes, to see faces, to see predators. We have hyperactive predator detection. How many of you have had the experience of catching something out of the corner of your eye that might have been like an animal or something? Oh, what was that? Did you see that? Okay. Being hyperactive in detecting predators is better than the opposite, right? So the people who were like, it's probably okay, they got eaten before they could have kids. It was terrible. So we've got these triggers, we've got these tendencies. That's where he's going with this. And what he wants to say, okay, let's go through the chart here, because we're going to get into groups and see if we can make sense of this chart. The adaptive challenges are the first thing to pay attention to. Protecting and caring for kids is probably our core evolutionary challenge. Humans have long gestation periods. Women are differentially affected by childbirth and child rearing. They're not, because of the way we feed kids and care for kids, we needed to, we had a problem to solve, and that was the problem was how to get both parents to invest energy into child rearing. And that's not an easy problem. Men could pursue a strategy of, you know, love them and leave them, right? Because genetically, the goal is to get your genes into the next generation. But that's not a good strategy for a species where the success of your kid is going to really depend on how much energy parents put into that, right? So given the way we have kids, protection and care for children is, he would say, one of our primary adaptive challenges. But we also have to figure out how to have good partnerships. We've talked about cheating and cooperation in partnerships, right? Remember, we talked about reputational interests and how we all have an interest in, you know, remember Vote For Me, Here's Why, that chapter where we're always updating our, checking on our status. Is everybody okay with me? Is anybody mad at me? How do people perceive me? Am I a good guy? Am I a good woman? So that idea of needing to be, our tendency to want to be perceived as trustworthy comes out of the evolutionary challenge of needing to form partnerships because we're a social species. We do better when we cooperate. Okay. The challenge behind loyalty and betrayal is that, you know, we are groupish. We have to be able to form effective groups. Most theorists agree that humans thrive through evolution because they learn how to cooperate in groups, not just in pairs. Now, the fourth one, authority subversion, you could mark this on your books. This is the Neolithic one. This is the one that comes after agriculture, because there's a lot of evidence in anthropology that this is, you know, maybe not an iron rule, but that hunter-gatherers were pretty egalitarian. They didn't have a lot of structure. They didn't always live in the same place for a long time, most people agree, just put it in your notes this way, most people agree that hierarchy comes with agriculture, with the Neolithic period. That's the last 10 to 12,000 years. So that fourth column is already, in my view, a kind of new foundation. I don't know that that comes out of our prehistory. So I'm a little puzzled about that one, but it's an important one. And then the last one, the fifth one, last for now. We'll get liberty and oppression later. That's a really ancient one, right? Because that has to do with avoiding contamination, sanctity, and degradation. Okay, so let's just real quickly follow how these get re-triggered. So care of children is still important, and we're still outraged. One of the things that everybody agrees across the political spectrum is that parents who don't take good care of their kids don't have a right to be parents, right? You can lose your kids if you don't take care of your kids. So that's a kind of, you know,
that's not a political issue, right? That's about and nobody thinks child pornography is okay. That's just gets really deep in our disgust level, you know. So that's a really interesting thing to see how humans have a consensus on those issues. But we re-triggered our sense of some of us. Now here liberals and conservatives will be different. Some of us re-trigger our sense of harm and harm avoidance and care to baby seals, cartoon characters, the environment, right? Okay, you see where we're going with this? So with each of these foundations, you've got an original trigger, which he thinks comes out of our past, and a contemporary. Hey, there's a good one for today, thinking about the Zags, loyalty and betrayal. We re-trigger that to sports teams, right? So the idea of being loyal to a sports team, that can't have come out of our evolutionary past. We did not play basketball 50,000 years ago, right? So, but the idea that we would feel loyalty to a group sounds very plausible. We know that humans lived in small groups for many tens of thousands of years. Okay. By the way, I have a really timely betrayal story to tell you. Can I digress on that right now? Tell me how you react to this. Oh my God, I can't wait to tell you. This just happened this year. You know, my son was friends with this guy named Cody Dellastrada. In fact, Cody Dellastrada was at my son's fifth birthday party. That's how far back they go. Now, they weren't like close friends. I think at age five, that was kind of the apex of their friendship. But, you know, it was part of that, you know, you have your social group, and Cody Dellastrada was in the social group. And he went off to be a writer. He wanted to be a writer, so he wrote some things he got some things put into BuzzFeed. He got some things, you know, he was making some progress. Got some things in the New Yorker blog, you know, and he got an article in The Guardian, which is a pretty prompt. You know this story? You know where I'm going? Oh, my God. Can you imagine? He wrote an article in The Guardian. How many of you have seen this? He trashed Spokane. He betrayed his hometown. He wrote an article saying that Spokane is a pathetic place where the only thing we've got is basketball. And if it weren't for basketball, we'd all kill ourselves. I mean, it was a horrible article. Oh, my God. And as I was reading it, I was thinking, he's betraying us. How could he do this? You don't trash your hometown. My advice to you today is if you're ever given an opportunity to become famous by trashing your hometown, don't do it. It's not worth it. A lot of people in his social group kind of, my son's in social group, kind of said to him, look, you got to write an apology. And it got pretty bad. Like, he was denounced in the local spokesman review. They wrote a parody of his article. Oh, my God. That's what you do to traitors. So anyway, you can see that. I mean, the point is relevant to today. I mean, loyalty and betrayal don't matter equally to all humans, right? So we're going to see in a couple of chapters how liberals and conservatives map onto these foundations in different ways. Just to end the suspense, liberals tend to have a two-channel morality. You're going to learn this in a whole chapter, right? Conservatives tend to have a five- or six-channel morality. So his claim is that liberals tend to be focused on these two foundations. But whether you're liberal or not, you can feel Cody Dellastrada's mistake. He was not loyal. He betrayed us. The hell with him. No, because except for the fact that he apologized, I would say, the next time I saw him, I'd say, I regret inviting you to my son's fifth birthday. You sullied my memory of it. Anyway. All right, so here's what we need to do in groups, and in a way, Cody Dellastrada gives us the example here. What I'd like you to do is find examples from everyday life of each of these foundations in your experience. And if you can't, let's figure that out, because Haidt's claim is that these are central and pervasive. He doesn't know if he's got exactly the right five, and he fudges on, you know, he comes up with a six. His theory doesn't depend on being exactly right about these being the exact five. His theory depends on him being pretty right that this captures a lot of what's going on in moral life. Okay, so one of the jobs in small groups is to see if he's right about that. And one way to test that is to say, can you easily find examples of moral reactions you would have, like the Cody Dellastrada infamy, to each of these foundations, and in searching for those and sharing those from your experience, do you come up with problems? Do you have difficulty finding some, or are the categories ambiguous? So that's what I'd like you to do for 5 to 7 minutes in small groups. Try to test this moral foundation theory by seeing if you can easily exemplify it in your experience, and if doing that raises complicated questions or problems, let's see if we can get those out on the table, okay? Can we do that for, actually we could do it for 10 minutes and then let the ticket people try to get their tickets. That'd be great. Okay? Okay, go ahead and start that. Catch up with each other. Make sure you know who you're talking to. Keep talking. Look at each other.
Her charges have been pressed since 19.
You know.
Yeah, I guess I don't know.
That's great.
Yeah.
Okay, guys, let's see what we can do to come together here.
Yeah, our ticket people are going to be distracted. They did their work. You guys just focus. I want to hear a good result about the ticket.
All right, so how hard was it to locate examples of these? Was this easy? It was accessible? Okay, good. That's a good indication for the theory. I want to kind of get into some other appraisals of the theory, but let's get a bunch of examples from your discussion about what, I'll mention mine later, but just kind of volunteer examples that came up. Maybe some of you told stories. How many of you located stories from your personal experience, or who wants to start us off? You have one? Okay, come on, you guys were talking a lot. You know, I heard a lot of talk. Some of it had, I recognized other basketball teams in the discussion. But, you know, okay, yeah. So what would be an example for Care Heart? Does anybody, okay, I'll do mine. You guys add yours. How about that? Abuse of animals is a trigger, a current trigger for care harm for many people. I mean, there are people, I've known people who don't get too bothered by hearing about bad things being done to animals, and that's getting to be a pretty weird attitude, right? If you could joke about, like, people who could, like, cockfighting where you set poultry at each other, roosters to hurt each other, that's pretty horrible. But there are people who do that still. Healthcare is a good one. Now, that one's in tension with liberty oppression, because you could have an impulse, or you could have an impulse that most modern, most rich countries have to take care of the health of everybody in the country, but you could see that as oppressive. So when we get to liberty or oppression, you'll see that some of these are in tension. Harming enemies. In some cases, I think the lower term is actually not always a bad thing. I think sometimes it is good to be able to. There might be moral causes where you need to be able to use violence. What were your care harm things? What came up in your discussions under care harm? Yes?
This is kind of going after healthcare one, but I just thought of, like, immunizations for school kids.
Ah, very good. That's a really good... You see how that's a kind of group care harm thing, right? We don't get the... but it's a good... Notice that also pits a couple of things, because you have to kind of be going with... You can't be subversive to the authority. Vaxxers are people who don't buy the authority of the medical community when it comes to preventing this harm. So we'll see connections. Good. Other? Okay. Fairness cheating. I overheard somebody talk about, like, noticing a student cheating, partner cheating. People, how many of you, if you became aware that a friend of yours was cheating on their romantic partner, would feel some urge to divulge that information? Raise your hand if you would feel that. Yeah. It'd be interesting to see if that was gendered. I think it's... Am I right? You feel it whether you're a guy or a woman? I don't know. Anyway, yeah, I think we feel that. You might feel disgust if you don't find out that the person ended the other relationship. Okay? The big example... Oh, did you guys have one for fairness and cheating? Any new ones? No? So for loyalty and betrayal, the example we used was writing a critique of your hometown. Did anybody have some others? What would be an example of from your own experience of how many of you have been involved in a group endeavor where somebody at the end just bailed and didn't show up? Right. Most people have had that experience at some level, right? So that's the kind of example we're talking about, right? You can hear birds now. Isn't that wonderful? Authority and subversion. This is a complicated one. Like I said, this one's post-agriculture, as far as I can tell. I think it makes sense. But sometimes the right thing to do is to be a subversive, to be a revolutionary. So I don't think that this is always a case where this term is a failure of moral response. Just like sometimes it might be a morally good thing if you can harm your enemies. Oh, did we get a result?
Yep.
You got it?
Yeah.
Okay, good. How about the rest of you? Who else is trying?
We're good.
Oh, it came through pretty fast. good. Okay, so now you can come back to ethics.
Good.
Now you can focus back on it. Westboro Baptist Church. Does anybody remember them? Horrible people. Sorry, sometimes you can say, I mean, I don't think there's two sides to the Westboro Baptist Church. Anybody who remembers them, remember what did they do?
I'm sure they were picketing funerals for military people. They were terrorizing Planned Parenthood locations.
Right. And so they would go to funerals of military people, especially if they knew that the person was gay, and they would say horrible things. Notice that gets at authority pretty directly. Flag burning shocked some people, but some people who were politically liberal and in times when flags were burned would say, well, no, that's what you got to do. Got to be subversive. This authority, see, if you think the authority is immoral, then being subversive is a good thing, right? Yeah.
Why were they on campus last year?
Oh, that's right. Yeah. What was there? There was an excuse.
Was
it a funeral?
It might have been, but...
Yeah, I think sometimes they just show up to protest.
We only need
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah, you know what the result with them was? It's an interesting free speech case. The federal government passed a law saying you can't protest at a military funeral. That ended that, which is good. But a lot of municipalities also put in laws requiring a setback from funerals for protesters. And notice this is a way of morally saying that, you know, that you can't, you know, it's preserving the CARE Foundation from this kind of behavior. Okay. So, and then secondary degradation, the obvious place to look would be sexual areas, but the contemporary trigger would be pollution. An original trigger would be contaminants. There's this weird human rights case I'll tell you about.
So, I guess I'm not understanding where this comes from. Do we have to experience a disgust reaction in order to identify with these things?
Not everybody's going to be disgusted by all the things that fall under these. We're gonna vary in the strength of reaction. Like I said, liberals are gonna have a two-channel. He's gonna bring evidence forward to suggest that liberals tend to confine their moral responses more to this. So, although liberals tend to value subversion more than conservatives, right? Is that where you're going? Does that help? Okay. You know, the human rights case I was going to tell you is kind of weird. I came across it because I'm doing research on free speech. And the European Court of Human Rights has a protection against self-degradation. So, you know, you can't let somebody do something to you that's degrading, especially for entertainment of others. And there was a case brought because... I know this is really I'm embarrassed to even tell you about this. People like to watch very small people shot out of cannons. That's like amusing for people. And so this very small person who is, yeah, I think a dwarf or a midget, I'm not sure which, he was letting himself be used in that way. And people brought a case that he shouldn't, that was self-degrading. And he fought back. He said, no, I'm fine. Thank you. It's okay. We're all getting a kick out of it. Can you think of other examples where it's borderline not okay? Like borderline...
Clowns.
Clowns in general, you think?
Well, they're usually very self-degrading.
Right. So certain kind of comic behavior. This triggers, like when you listen to a comedian who really gets raunchy or really says really inappropriate things, that would be similar to the clown example. Yeah, good. Others? Yeah, so there are difficult cases. I mean, there's cases where you might say this is degrading to most people, but you know, for the person involved, they may have a different view. Most of you probably believe that sex work is degrading, but in places like Germany, sex workers are arguing that this is their job, this is what they do. So we have to. I mean, one of the things we can step back from this foundations and realizes it's, make sure this is in your notes, the moral foundations don't tell us what's right, right? And notice that's a big difference from our philosophical ethical theories, right? Our philosophical ethical theories were about saying, act always so that you promote the greatest good for the greatest number. Act always so that you treat others as an end and not only as a means, right? Mill, Kant. So our philosophical theories are about telling us what goodness is. This is an explanatory theory. We've made that distinction before, so let's make sure that's in your notes. This is not a justificatory theory. That's what philosophical theories try to do. They try to justify our intuitions about what morality is and how we should act. So one problem with this theory is it's not designed to tell us what counts as degradation. Whether the dwarf is right or everybody else is right, you know, whether it's degrading to let people sell their bodies for sex, or those are going to be things that we talk about. Haidt's point is that we're going to talk about them in relation. We're going to have a public policy discussion that's very contemporary, but these moral concerns go back to really ancient, basic evolutionary challenges that we faced. Okay, now there's a lot more to the story, but I mean, that's kind of what we needed right now. Questions about this? So one problem and question I'd get into your notes is, how do we use these moral foundations to figure out what's right? That's not an unanswered question at this point, right? It's not a normative theory. It's an explanatory theory. It's saying, you know, you notice how this is taking us beyond a wall. Instead of saying, you know, morality comes out of moral emotions, this is a theory that says, well, those moral emotions are part and parcel of evolutionary challenges that we've faced. And contemporary morality is about re-triggering those reactions to contemporary instances that we may not have experienced in our ancestral environment. So people, I'm pretty sure 30,000 years ago, nobody was worried about pollution. They were worried about, you know, defecating in a stream that they would drink water from, right? So that kind of pollution they would be worried about. But nobody was worried about climate change and ruining the environment. But we're able, because we were worried about contamination and poison in our ancestral environment, so now we can worry, if we choose to, we can make pollution of the environment an object of concern, and we can feel emotions. You notice what he's saying here. We can feel emotions like sanctity and purity when we, if you feel this as a trigger. Not everybody's going to feel this as a trigger. Likewise, if you go back to harm, you know, it's only recently that harm to people with non-standard sexual orientations, you know, was something that people worried about. For most of human history, those were people that we did mean things to. We didn't think that we had to be worried about caring for those people. So this idea of re-triggering is really important. Maybe we can end on that. Good luck getting your tickets and all that and making arrangements, and we'll see you next time. Okay? Thanks.